I don't understand it, Tina, because I've been in and around politics for a long time, and there are a lot of men who are really unlikable, who get themselves elected to very high positions.
If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes, but let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
I'm Tina Brown, and you're listening to TBD. If there's one consolation for Hillary Clinton in the agony of losing the 2016 election, it must surely be that in the popular vote, she actually beat Donald Trump by more votes than JFK, Nixon, and Gore combined beat Nixon, Humphrey, and Bush combined. And that her defeat ignited a political fire under so many women to run for office themselves. Historians of the future will marvel at what candidate Clinton went through in that campaign. A brutal two-year evisceration of Russian hacking, a tsunami of preposterous fake news that included reports she was part of a pedophile ring and secretly dying of cancer, months of rabid personal abuse from Trump that continues to this day, and what Bernie Sanders memorably called the damn email scandal that was capped off by the closing blunders of then-FBI Director James Comey, who styled himself as Inspector Javert but behaved more like Inspector Clouseau. You might ask, given what the Trump presidency has wrought after 2 years, why isn't Hillary Clinton crouched in a fetal position howling, or at the very least sitting beside a pool with a vat of gin? Because Hillary Clinton is the ultimate woman in the arena. She never gives up. She put on her Kevlar pantsuit and got back to work, once again using her voice clout and crackling intellect to talk about the real national emergencies we face in America today. I'm delighted to have her with me now to find out what's TBD for HRC. Welcome to TBD, Hillary Clinton.
Thank you so much, Tina. I'm delighted to be here with you.
Well, given what you've been through, yes, we do well to laugh richly. Yeah. And as what's happened to the democracy since? I mean, how can you read the news every day without just having a kind of primal scream?
Well, I'm not going to say that I don't have a primal scream because a lot of days that's exactly how I feel. It is a very concerning time, not only for our democracy, but for Western democracy overall. And I have had the great good fortune of being in the center of American politics for a long time now, and having served as Secretary of State. So I have a perspective about all of this, which gives me maybe more cause for concern than others might have.
What do you feel is the most agitating thing for you in the last 2 years that this administration has done? I mean, the thing that really has been something you find it very hard to live with.
The separating these children at the border has been the most outrageous action by this administration. Many other things concern me, I disagree with, but the level of inhumanity toward these families, separating these children without any concern about what happens to them, in fact, no system to track them. You know, many years ago, I wrote one of the earliest articles about children under the law. It was called in the Harvard Education Review. I've done a lot of legal work about what are the proper standards to try to prevent harm to kids. Worked on a book called Beyond the Best Interests of the Child with leading experts. So I have more than a passing knowledge about the damage that is done to children who are taken away from their families and who are put into not only strange but often hostile environments. So
you're seeing the lasting trauma.
It is lasting trauma. And what we're hearing now is that not only did they do it, but they've lied consistently about it. There are many, many hundreds more children who have been taken from families and who are, according to this administration, lost in the system, who will never be returned. Many of the families are without means, some of them illiterate in Spanish. They come from Central America, and they're indigenous Indian people whose language, first language, is not Spanish. They have often been deported, so they're not in this country to seek recourse or to try to find their children. And just recently we learned that a lot of these children have been turned over to organizations that seem to have no greater urgency than the government in trying to reunite them. And they may be rationalizing, well, we're going to give them a better home. That is just so terribly wrong in every way that you can think of it. So on a long list, that's at the top of my list.
Well, obviously, we're living through and waiting for the long-awaited Mueller report. Of all the indictments that Mueller's brought down so far, which do you think has been the most significant?
Look, I think that every one of them has been significant, but because they are individual indictments about either individuals, organizations, or groups, their full impact has not yet been fully grasped by the press or the public. So just from my perspective, the first big indictment that came down, which is often referred to as the Russian social media indictment, was devastating in terms of what we discovered about the interference in the election. The second indictment, again, of Russians, was devastating about the hacking of material, the theft of material, and not just the emails of DNC officials or John Podesta, but it was deeper and broader than that. And then, of course, the Flynn indictments, the Manafort indictments, the Cohen indictments. There is so much information out there that maybe will be all connected up in a final set of indictments and or a report, but there is enough grounds in what has already been made public for the government, for Congress in particular, to be doing more with it. And I'm pleased that under Speaker Pelosi, the Democrats are beginning to hold hearings and try to connect some of these dots. You might know, Tina, that many years ago I was on the impeachment inquiry staff for the House of Representatives investigating Nixon. And the public hearings that were held by the Watergate Special Committee were essential in helping to educate the public about what all this legal stuff meant. What does obstruction of justice mean, for example? And we haven't had that opportunity. Many of the hearings and witnesses have been behind closed doors in the investigation so far. There hasn't really been the kind of solemn, somber laying of facts and information before the public and the press that, you know, should happen in our democracy.
Do you find yourself looking back over the campaign and sort of joining up more and more of these dots? Because for you, it's not only just hearing this extraordinary series of indictments, but also wedding it back to what you went through. And you must be thinking all the time of all this stuff that was happening behind the scenes that you had no idea was going on at the time.
Well,
is that a very
even,
surreal thing?
But even what we thought we knew, particularly the theft of the emails, which from the DNC, which became clear relatively early in June, July of 2016, the Russians were behind. We couldn't get people to take that seriously. It just was too big a leap for the press or the public to think that there could be some kind of coordination, conspiracy, between someone running for president's campaign and Russian agents. I mean, who could believe that? And my team, bless their hearts, would go out there and try to make the case, and they were basically just shutdown.
Well, indeed, the media, I mean, the New York Times actually feasted on those emails.
Yes,
as
they did.
Great gossip leaks, and it wasn't helpful to you at all.
But, you know, there was really nothing to them. I mean, that's what was so strange about the obsession with both those emails and John Podesta's emails. I mean, what was the great revelation? That some people working in the Democratic National Committee didn't particularly like Bernie, who'd never been a Democrat? Well, boy, stop the presses. That's got to be news. Or that John Podesta had hundreds of emails, you know, about this problem, that problem, whatever we're going to do, his risotto recipe. I mean, there was nothing there.
Well, it's just the whole idea that something that's kept from the public eye is sort of sexier and juicier than something they're being told, which is a big weakness, of course, with media.
But that is the world in which we now live. And I did not fully appreciate that. I mean, I thought, well, really, I mean, what does this have to do with who's ever going to be the better president? I mean, it had nothing to do with it. But we're living in a time when people want to peek behind the curtain, even if it's a charade, even if it's a total stage-managed event that they are peeking behind. They somehow think that is more transparent, authentic, use your favorite word, and it is going to be further exploited. I mean, I worry greatly with the changes in technology that can put words in people's mouths that they have never said. You can take, you know, 10 words from 10 different speeches and piece them together and stick them in Barack Obama's mouth or, you know, mine or somebody else's, and we never said it the way it's coming across. So this is going to be one of the biggest threats to democracy, because we believe in a marketplace of ideas. We believe in free speech. But we also believe that what we're hearing is legitimate. And who knows whether that will be the case.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's Byte.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Ace.
You knew that Putin hated you because, amongst other things, you know, of the speech that you made in Lithuania in 2011 when you supported the free and fair elections in Russia, which he thought, didn't he, was fomenting protest against him. But when were you aware of how toxic his animosity towards you had become?
I had a very correct and somewhat oppositional relationship with him as Secretary of State. But I always was respectful. I always tried to find ways to work with him. And in numerous meetings, I would seek out topics that he might find interesting enough to break through the cold exterior that he displayed to everybody. That wasn't just
you
me.
You never got any kind of personal sense?
No, well, I did. I mean, yeah. I remember one time I was visiting with him out in his dacha outside Moscow, and he had started our meeting. It was just me and him and I think the ambassador and one of my aides on my side and then two aides on his side. And he started off the meeting in one of his kind of trademark antagonistic condescending approaches to the Russian press, where he would have the Russian press come in and he would say, oh, the United States, they will not, you know, work with us. They will not listen to us. You know, he'd do this. I wouldn't get a chance to respond. The Russian press would leave and then we would begin to talk. And I said to him in that conversation, you know, one thing that I think we might have in common, Mr. President, is your wildlife conservation work. And he just lit up. His eyes lit up. He said, come with me. He took me down the steps from the second floor where we had been meeting in his public reception room, you know, down a hallway, into a private office, surprising everybody when he opened the door, into his, you know, inner sanctum with this huge map on the wall of Russia, and started talking to me about what he was doing with, you know, tigers and polar bears and all of this. And I was able to do that a couple of times on issues that I'd studied up and thought about. What happened with the elections is that he felt vulnerable. He had turned over the presidency for a period of years to Medvedev and had been acting as prime minister, and then he decided he wanted it back, and so he just announced it, you know, we're going to change back again. And then, you know, 2 months later, they had the parliamentary elections, and it was so clear that they were not free, they were not fair, they were very much manipulated to favor his party. And I spoke out, as I would speak out about, you know, fraudulent elections anywhere, including in our own country. But that just got him so upset, because for the first time, the people of Russia were responding. You know, it had nothing to do with me going through the, you know, formulaic Secretary of State criticism of an unfair election. It had to do with tens of thousands of Russians in the streets in Moscow, St. Petersburg, and elsewhere. And he was scared, because he had seen what had happened in Georgia. He had seen what had happened in Ukraine, and he was scared. And so he needed an enemy. So the enemy had to be the United States, and then he wanted to personify it, so he blamed me for the demonstrations. I think hate's too strong a word. I think he saw me as a worthy adversary, which I think I was. And he clearly favored in the campaign, first in the primary, Bernie Sanders, who had a long history of being very favorable toward Russia. And then he favored Trump, who he had reason to believe would be also incredibly favorable. So I don't attribute an emotion to Putin. He's too cold-blooded for that. This was a calculation.
Right. And but when did you realize that he was starting to weaponize information? And
well, we saw it happen in other places. I just didn't realize that it would be so effective in the United States. He took advantage of our openness and our incredulity about sources of information.
Okay, so we know that he's going to be full bore in 2020.
Yes, we
know that. We know that, and we know it's not going to be pretty. So, I mean, what do you think it's now going to take to beat Trump, given we know all of this other stuff is going to also be in play?
I think you've asked a really important question, Tina, because as I learned and as the country learned, you've got to figure out how to beat him in the Electoral College. I have called for the abolition of the Electoral College since 2000 when I saw what it did to Al Gore, which I thought was wrong. I mean, I believe in one person, one vote, and this is a remnant of slavery. It was a compromise in the original Constitution. But nevertheless,
and you got 3 million more in the popular vote.
Well, you know, 2 days after the election, I heard an interview with a French political commentator who said, "Well, leading up to the Macron election," and he said something like, "Well, you know, unlike your country, in ours, the person who gets the most votes wins." It's a problem with the democracy. It's not just a problem with me or Al Gore. It is a problem, but. What I think is going to be very important is that the Democratic Party, Democratic candidates, understand the power of the Republican / Trump / Russian approach toward manipulating information. You know, I have immersed myself in every academic study, any independent, well-researched analysis about, okay, what really happened. And there is so much evidence now that people don't necessarily go into their social media feeds. They don't go onto Facebook, which is the biggest purveyor of news in the world, expecting to be fooled. They expect to be able to rely on what they see there. And if you don't have a skepticism about what the information is, where it comes from, who it advantages, it's very easy to believe it.
Well, it's a hard thing to beat.
Because it's
like a virus that you can't get your hands
on. But now at least we know. I mean, from my perspective, we ran a good campaign that was kind of the Obama 2.0 campaign. You know, I obviously had hired a lot of Obama's people. They were incredibly able. They did a great job. But Trump, the Russians, Cambridge Analytica, all of his assorted allies were running a campaign in an entirely different arena. And I don't think I or my people understood that. You know, we would see a little pop-up story that, you know, some idiot says that Pope Francis endorsed Donald Trump. Who's going to believe that? How ridiculous. Now, we know we live in the, you know, Fox political echo chamber. But the people who predominantly get their news from Fox were not very accessible to any Democrat. You know, no Democrat has carried, you know, the white vote in some elections. So we knew that, and we didn't think that it would be that impactful, but we did not fully appreciate how playing on the margins on so many of these stories. You don't believe that one? Here comes another one. Hey, how about this?
The sheer volume. We know that Trump is going to run on the idea that Democrats are job killers, and they're probably going to use Amazon.
Right.
Amazon bailing on New York City. If you were still the senator for New York, would you have been fighting for that deal to keep it?
I don't know if I would have been fighting for that deal. I might have very well stepped in and tried to fight for a better deal and a better communications and rollout strategy around the deal that was struck. It did, I think, rub a lot of people the wrong way that it was laid down as a kind of fait accompli. And I think there could have been a better negotiation earlier, but I don't know that. I mean, I was not involved. I mean, it is great that New York is becoming a much more tech-friendly city with not just Amazon. They already have actually some, you know, couple thousand jobs here, but so does Google and Facebook and all the rest of them. So I think there could have been a way to come up with a deal that would have withstood whatever blowback there'd been.
We've got a flood of candidates right now
throwing
their hats in the ring. Who do you think right now has the best path to win? I mean, that has the best
I don't know. It's way too early.
This stacking is like, of all the coins and all the side, like, well, who's got the best path?
I don't, you know, really, it's just introduction time. People are introducing themselves other than probably Biden and Sanders, who have a lot of name recognition and top most polls that have been done up till now. It is just so unpredictable. I mean, who will strike a chord? And everybody is on their best behavior. Right now, they are all, you know, being incredibly gracious to each other. They're all trying to present their best presentation that hopefully brings people to them, doesn't drive people away from them. It's just way too soon.
-harvest.com. We have four strong women running now for president. Senators Harris, Warren, Klobuchar, and Gillibrand. What do you see as the particular stresses that those women have to face?
Well, I think that my having gone through it last time should make it a little easier because a lot of what was done under the old double standard is more understood now. And I think more people call out the press and, you know, commentators for the comments they make, which they don't make about male candidates. So I do think that the pathway is a little bit easier, but by no means it's not equivalent to the, you know, male candidates. It's, even in the last month, we've seen, you know, the kind of attacks on the four women running for all kinds of different things and certain words like likable and all that used.
Is it like, do you think that women candidates are doomed to have that likable thing stuck on them? I mean, reading the pieces about Senator Klobuchar, you know, how she was mean to her staff and how she used the comb to eat a salad and everything on the front page of the Times, you know, I just thought, why are they also required to be likable?
I don't understand it, Tina, because I've been in and around politics for a long time, and you have certainly seen so much in your, you know, journalistic career. There are a lot of men who are really unlikable, who get themselves elected to very high positions. But I don't understand fully why the press just sort of defaults to these sloppy, unfair characterizations. And at least though people are being called out about it now. I mean, there's so much back and forth on social media when one of the women candidates is pigeonholed or treated in a disrespectful way or words used that wouldn't be used for male candidates. At least people are calling it out. So I don't know that we're going to, you know, see a big sea change, but I'm hoping that we're going to see enough so that there can be a really fair competitive race.
The trouble with beating Trump is it is so much more than a political calculation, isn't it? I mean, I kind of keep thinking about the only thing that's important is the visuals almost of that debate stage, you know, that you know, he's big, he's a big lowering guy. I mean, he was hovering around you like Jaws. I mean, you know, that he tells these huge lies. It's like, who is going to be, it's almost like, it's not even a political calculation so much as who has got the physicality, the presence to be on that stage with Trump.
Well, I don't know that it matters in a way. I was, you know, people who follow these things said I won all three debates, and I did win the popular vote. So it's where the Electoral College forces your attention that you now have to be aware of how you're being seen in a relatively small slice of America. And, you know, there's a lot of problems with that. But I think we saw in the 2018 midterm elections, that his bullying behavior has worn thin for a lot of voters, and particularly women voters, and particularly kind of the Republican, moderate, independent woman voter in the suburbs of, you know, you name it, Pennsylvania or Ohio or Michigan, that they now have had enough, that maybe initially this triggered some kind of image of a leader. So what does a leader look like? Well, he's a man, and probably a big man. So, okay, he may not be my cup of tea, but he's kind of my stereotype of what a leader looks like. I think a lot of people, particularly led, again, by women and young people, are saying, wait a minute, no, he's not. You know, he's a bully, and he is not a good leader.
I have to say, I'm always so impressed with how you deal with these confrontations. I actually think you're at your best when you're under attack, as a matter of fact.
Could be.
And I'm not quite sure why that would be. I mean, I remember in the Benghazi hearings, I mean, you just sort of aced it. Do you find that you actually sort of thrive when that kind of bully gets into your face? Does this bring something out in you to fight back?
Well, as a very young girl, I was like 4 years old, and we had just moved to the suburbs of Chicago, and my mother would get me all dressed up every day, put me, you know, out the door to go play, and I'd get beaten up every day. And I would run back in crying. And finally, memorably, she told me, there's no room for cowards in this house. You go back out there. Mm. It was a stunning order by my mother. But I think about it often, because she knew that If I was going to be an independent, self-sufficient person, I couldn't just get crumpled by the bullies of the world. So she basically taught me how to stand up for myself. So that is not uncomfortable to me, but it goes back to your prior question. How does a woman stand up for herself on the biggest stage in the world without, number one, looking aggressive, maybe a little bit angry that somebody is behaving like that, being willing to go toe-to-toe when there are so few memories embedded in our collective DNA where women do that. So, yes, I'm willing to stand up for what I believe in, even more than myself, what I care about, what I fight for. But that is still kind of scary for some people. So how do you get on this kind of Goldilocks path where you're not too strong and you're not too weak, you're not too aggressive and you're not too passive? This is still a problem for women on the public stage, and it's something that you just have to keep working
on. Yeah, not that you don't want to fight or can't fight, but the manner of the fighting.
Exactly.
And what is going to be acceptable.
I mean, you know, I've seen lots of women as well as men, and sometimes the way you think you're coming across can be filtered in a way that you didn't even imagine. And it's just trial and error. And the fact that we have these other women running now, I think, is all to the good, because then it's not just one woman, you know, and you hold her to an impossible standard because she's the only one out there. Now, you know, look, these women have different styles. They have different public speaking approaches. So now maybe we'll begin to get a little more understanding that, you know what, women can be different too.
If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Well, when you first joined the Senate, you kept a pretty low profile, mm-hmm. and you spent the first year sort of assiduously learning the ways of the Senate, forging, you know, relationships across the aisle. Do you think that some of these new women in Congress, who we're all excited about, should sort of learn more about the institution before they hit the social media? I mean, that's not your style. You really yes. spend a lot of time working mm-hmm. across the aisle, sort of going out of your way to show that, you know, you were new in the institution.
Well, I think I came in with a set of expectations and an amount of scrutiny that was unusual for that time, having been First Lady and then being elected senator from New York. I think you have to do both. If you live in the world of social media, which is the main vehicle for communicating with people on a regular basis, you've got to do that. If you want to get something done in the Congress, you've got to forge relationships. You have to understand how a bill becomes a law. I mean, obviously, that's part of the job. So I don't see it as either or for this new generation. I think they have to do both.
Mm-hmm. Nancy Pelosi has gone through the most incredible image transformation.
I love it.
I mean, I think if she wasn't a woman, people would actually be saying, comparing her to LBJ right now. I'd love your take on the trajectory mm-hmm. of the last year and why you think she's been so effective at blowing Trump off his game.
Well, Nancy was effective throughout her entire career in the House. I mean, you don't get elected leader and then speaker by your peers just because, you know, you're nice to them. They make a hard-hearted judgment as to who can best lead them. So she had been leader for years, but she'd also, somewhat like me, I guess you'd have to say, been demonized by the Republicans and the press that went along with that for years. I mean, she was in negative ads all the time. She was attacked all the time. So that spills over. And I think that a lot of the opposition to her was incredibly opportunistic by the Republicans. They were aware of how effective she had been. She got the Affordable Care Act passed. She got a cap and trade bill for climate change passed. I mean, she was an enormously successful speaker. So bottom line, she had a great record, but she'd been beaten up. And so people ended up believing things about her that were totally untrue. And some of the members who said they were going to be against her got sucked into that. You know, some of the people running in 2018 got set up where the press in their district would say, well, are you going to vote for Nancy Pelosi? Well, it's just easier. You've never really worked with her. You don't really have any allegiance to her. You don't really know what you're walking into. You say, no, I'm not. So some of them had to go against her. Some others, you know, they're impatient because they want new leadership. They want to be part of that new leadership. I got all of that. But at the end of the day, there wasn't anybody who would be a more effective leader and speaker once the Democrats won to stand up for our values and to take on the Republicans and Trump in particular. And she has proven that.
Right. It's kind of something rather gratifying about the sort of her expertise triumphing.
Absolutely.
Well, one thing that has seemed to be no longer really a factor in politics is age, right? So, yes.
On both ends of the spectrum.
That's right. Joe Biden, 76. Bernie Sanders, 77. Michael Bloomberg, 77. Donald Trump, 72. Hillary Clinton, 71.
That's
right?
True.
You've said you're not running. Are there any circumstances in which you would ever change your mind?
I can't imagine that, no. I think that I've had a terrific experience in public life and in politics. I care deeply about this country, and I am very worried about the direction that Trump and his allies are taking us. So I will continue to speak out and fight for our basic rights, particularly when it comes to how we treat each other and also the rule of law. I'm a lawyer, a recovering lawyer, as I like to say. So there are things that I care deeply about that just because I'm not running, I'm not going to keep, you know, my mouth shut. I'm going to keep speaking out.
Are you shocked by the absolute jelly-like submission of the GOP to Trump? I mean, Lindsey Graham is one of these people who it's people are just stunned.
Well, I am stunned. I am stunned. I mean, I really miss John McCain. For all of his curmudgeonly ways, he was willing to stand up and take on Trump. And I'll never forget him voting against the effort to repeal the Affordable Care Act. These other Republicans are scared. They're scared of him. They're scared of his voters. And they are selling out the country and our future. They are undermining our institutions. They are, you know, trafficking in lies to basically be in line with Trump. So, yes, I served with some of them in the Senate. I worked with others when I was Secretary of State.
Do you see a big change from Lindsey Graham?
I see a level of fear and cowardice that is shocking to me. And the ones who stood up and spoke out, they retired. They left because they were scared and disgusted that they didn't even think they could win a primary in places they'd represented for years.
Well, you've been Secretary of State. How do you grade Mike Pompeo? And what are you thinking about this current, the way Trump is handling the North Korea overtures?
I think that Pompeo understands the only way that he can be influential is to align himself with Trump. He will occasionally break ranks, but he probably does it only after alerting Trump and making an argument that this is actually smart of us to do. So the other day he said, yeah, you know, Kim Jong-un has nuclear weapons and he's not likely to give them up. Which is contrary to, you know, Trump's fantasy about negotiating with the North Koreans. So I think that all the intelligence, which Trump dismisses, suggests that it's unlikely, if not impossible, that Kim Jong-un will give up his nuclear weapons capacity. So now Trump's on his way to, I guess, Hanoi to meet in Vietnam with Kim Jong-un, and I don't see a deal there that is a verifiable, enforceable deal. I don't know what Trump will claim, but I have serious doubts that whatever he claims will be actually achieved. What worries me, Tina, is I saw where Sergei Lavrov is in Vietnam. You know, the Russians have a big stake in destabilizing the current arrangement in the Korean Peninsula, as do the Chinese. The Chinese would be very happy to have American troops out of South Korea, to have the nuclear umbrella that has protected South Korea by treaty torn up by this American president. And I don't know whose national security interests Trump is either pursuing or will actually try to defend.
Which is an extraordinary statement when you about it, actually.
It is an extraordinary statement.
But do you think, I mean, what do you think that he gets out of this face-to-face? Simply a publicity moment at a time when Mueller may be about to drop?
I think there's certainly that, because he cares deeply about theater. I mean, people wonder what he does all day when he's not at work, what they call executive time. He watches a lot of television because he's trying to see how events are being perceived by his voters. He's kind of given up on expanding his base. And I think that he is also planning all the time. Like, how can I look? What are the perceptions? He's much more interested in perceptions than reality. And at the end of the day, I think that he would love to get a Nobel Prize. I mean, that was the biggest joke of the week, where he got Abe to, you know, nominate him for a Nobel Prize by getting a deal and claiming it. And, you know, this is what he used to do in real estate deals. I've had so many guys who did business with him in real estate say, you know, he'd have a $15 million profit from a real estate deal, which he would call $150 million, and then he would call everybody and beg them not to contradict the press because he was going to tell them it was $150 million, not $15 million. That's how he sees negotiation. So if he can put lipstick on a pig and he can say, okay, this is what we're going to do with North Korea, and he keeps saying it over and over again, and Fox News says it over and over again, and other outlets say it over and over again, and the so-called mainstream media does their both sides-ism. Well, he said this, but then somebody else said
so
that.
He wins the news cycle.
He wins the news cycle, and it's really what he lives for.
Okay, so before we wrap up, Hillary, let's just return to sanity for 1 minute. Your daughter Chelsea and Mark, of course, are expecting their third child.
Yes.
I mean, how much fun is it to be more present as a grandmother?
It is so much fun. And we're lucky they live close by because we can see them often, and so far they haven't put a no trespassing sign up. We go by all the time. And just watching these two little people grow up and become themselves is thrilling. So it is something that I'm incredibly grateful for.
Well, Hillary, thank you so much for being with us today. You are the most courageous, tenacious, resilient woman I've ever encountered. And I'm very glad that you're not screaming and howling into a closet, as I perhaps posited at the beginning. It's been great to hear you.
Oh, it's great
today.
To talk to you, Tina. I really enjoyed it.
You've been listening to TBD with me, Tina Brown, brought to you by Wondery. You can subscribe to TBD on Apple Podcasts, follow us on Spotify, or keep up with us however you listen to podcasts. If you like what you heard today, please spread the word, tweet about it, Instagram it, or, you know, try having an actual conversation with a real person. TBD is produced by Tina Brown, Kathleen Russo, Julie Subrin, Karen Compton, Justin Giannino, and Michael Solomon. Original theme music is composed by Forrest Gray. And if you like this conversation, check out my sessions with the ever-fascinating Aaron Sorkin and with the feminist crusader Gretchen Carlson. Come back next time for more smart people on TBD.